This is a clip from a video that can be found on the Sick Weather website. The speaker is standing in front of a map of the United States. It looks like a typical weather segment on local TV news, but with a twist.
Hi, meteorologist Justin Berg here with the U.S. Sick Weather Forecast for the week of March 4th, 2013. Let's jump right in with the flu. That peaked back in December and January, but it's still very prevalent in many regions of the U.S. In fact, as you can see on sickweather.com, we're forecasting a slight increase in flu activity this week, even though it's on the way out. So many regions in the path of that winter storm, from the Ohio Valley stretching on into the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, especially that region we call Contagion Alley between D.C. and up towards Boston. Now let's not forget the other half of cold and flu season, colds. We're seeing a lot of activity with cold symptoms.
If you think the idea of prognosticating outbreaks of illness sounds a bit mad, Sick Weather seems to be onto something. In the fall of 2012, they made headlines for predicting the onset of flu season weeks earlier than the Center for Disease Control. I sat down this week with Sick Weather co-founder and CEO Graham Dodge, and he explained how the site works.
Sick Weather is sort of best described as being like the Doppler radar for sickness. We have this patent-pending process that we developed that distills data from Facebook and Twitter to generate these real-time, what we like to call weather maps of illnesses, so that really for the first time ever, people can see in real time what's going around in their area from a country level all the way down to a street level. And this is like taking a global census, you know, every few minutes, and that allows us to really track illness from a completely different perspective.
And that's using social media. And I mean, I'm the kind of person that thinks of social media as sort of like a internet playground. But you can actually find some real information there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was as a result of this process that we have and looking at symptoms related to flu this past year that helped us to identify that the flu season was starting earlier than normal. In fact, we announced that the flu season was starting 6 weeks before the CDC recognized or announced that there was an early flu season.
And the Center for Disease Control has been doing this for a lot longer than you have.
Absolutely,
so.
Yeah.
So for you to have better data, that's saying something about this collection process. Now, what sort of data are you talking about?
It's anecdotal data. It's people going on Facebook and Twitter saying things like my kid has bronchitis or my friends have scurvy or, you know, whatever they're saying.
Stomach flu,
right,
things like that. Or,
right.
Yeah.
On social media. Now, the reports have to be made public for us to be able to see them. And we have to have location information associated with them to be able to then map them and track it. But using that process, we've had, you know, not only did we identify the early flu season this past year, but a year before, we actually were able to forecast, if you will, whooping cough in a town called Algonquin, Illinois, 2 weeks before the media reported the outbreak.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That information can be very useful. Something like whooping cough is rare enough and serious enough mm-hmm. that it's good for doctors to know what they're facing. I always thought it was funny when I'd call, you know, when my child would be sick and I'd call the doctor uh-huh. and he would say, tell me the symptoms, and he would know. He'd have heard from other people. And there's some sort of comfort in knowing that you're not alone in your disease.
That's
a funny thing, but there is something nice about knowing that you're not alone. There is a treatment.
Right.
The doctor's prepared to deal with you. But to see that a little earlier seems like a very useful thing.
Well, yeah, the timing of it's really crucial because it allows for early warning and allows for public health organizations to respond sooner, allows for pharmacies to stock up on, you know, flu vaccines sooner.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, if it gets the word out to everybody to start washing their hands a little bit more often, knowing that flu is starting, that could really have a profound impact.
It's true, because you do become more vigilant when you get a diagnosis.
Right. Exactly.
When I, this past winter, I myself was very sick. I went to the doctor and they swabbed me for the flu and they were very excited to find that I had the type B strain. And I was like feeling very terrible at the doctor, but it was kind of funny to watch them. They were like, what? You tested positive for the B strain. Because I knew then that they would report those results to the CDC, that I would become part of this database and that they would see these trends and they'd know. Unfortunately, in my case, there's nothing really to do for you very much but go home and rest. But I knew that I was very contagious and that I should keep to myself.
And you mentioned earlier about how you said we have better data than the CDC. And I would say it's not technically better data. You know, obviously, the data that they're collecting is very highly qualified through the hospitals and doctor reports that they're getting, that the diagnosed incidences of flu, like how you were just swabbed and they determined it was the B strain. You know, in social media, we're getting, again, it's much more of a early warning overview. It's just, it's different data. It's not better data. It's different.
Yeah, and people self-reporting, you know, some people would say that's very unreliable, except that people do tend to say, you know, I feel lousy. And it's funny, when this came to my attention, I realized how many posts you do see people telling you how terrible they feel. You know?
Yeah.
It's one of those markers that people want to put out there about themselves.
Well, and we're working with advisors from Johns Hopkins University who are specialists in using Twitter to track influenza, Dr. Mark Dredzi and his PhD student, Michael Paul. They have really helped, you know, further this field of research with some white papers that they produced, one of which is called You Are What You Tweet. And so I encourage anybody to go out and look those up online. My point being that this sort of novel source of data, as it's been referred to by organizations like the CDC, really actually has been proven through extensive research to effectively track and predict flu outbreaks.
I wonder if it's frustrating to people who are used to dealing with much more like nuts and bolts, real science, real data. Does it drive them crazy or is it kind of intriguing? I mean, it sounds like these researchers you've hooked up with find it very interesting.
They do, and they're not the only ones. We're also working with a professor in Texas named Professor David Larry, who's associating our data with actual weather data, for example. So there's this whole sort of spectrum of anecdotal data that, you know, we've all sort of assumed over the years throughout human history that things are associated with, certain things are associated with sickness. And now we're actually able to kind of, through this, you know, daily census online of social media, be able to actually pull these things together and actually form a model, a predictive model that actually is accurate. We're finding all sorts of correlations through this research. Just recently, we noticed the correlation between allergies and insomnia. So, you know, there's actually been research done that shows that hay fever, for example, the cellular inflammation that occurs as a result to a reaction to a hay fever reaction, actually can lead to sleep disturbances. And our data now is starting to actually support that and show that insomnia, that allergy season, is also insomnia season on sick weather.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned there is a website, you know, there is a place where people can find this information. It's not just like you don't just keep it to yourselves. So you can go to sickweather.com and see these maps, which they really are maps, and you see these clusters of illness. But also, you can provide data directly to the site. Users can actually send stuff directly to you, right?
Right. You can report directly. So if you're not one to, you know, talk about these kinds of things on Facebook and Twitter, you can go directly to SickWeather and report directly to us and anonymously. So you don't have to, or if you wanted to, we actually allow that you can share your posts on Facebook and Twitter if you want. But yeah, we do allow for self-reporting, and it's a free, you know, set up a free member account. And with that account, you can also get a free, one free email alert. So you can almost like credit card, you know, fraud monitoring. We can help you monitor whatever symptom or illness that you're interested in being notified about. But then you can also sign up to have a subscription to up to 28 different symptoms and illnesses that we track.
Wow, it's like the hypochondriac's dream.
Right.
How did you come to this? What led you to this site?
I'm a hypochondriac. No, it's a combination of my sort of background in web development. A long time ago, in the first dot-com bubble, I was part of a team that developed the first crime map in the U.S., an online crime map that was an aggregate model of U.S. Census crime data along with individual police blotter data from different police stations around the country. And so I've had that background. And one summer, I got a stomach virus, or at least I thought it was a stomach virus. I really wasn't sure if it was that or if it was food poisoning. And my first inclination was to go onto Facebook and to see, you know, who among my other friends were talking about these symptoms. And sure enough, I found somebody, a friend of mine in D.C. nearby, who was experiencing the same symptoms. And that's when it occurred to me that using the APIs for Facebook and Twitter, that we could actually develop a process that could, you know, aggregate all those posts that are public and filter them and map them like a weather map.
Now, I'm sort of woefully ignorant about how this, what becomes public. What is the data you can see?
On Twitter, it's most of the data. It's the default user profile is public. So
right.
That's, so, you know, at the end of our filtration process, we're left with a lot more data from Twitter than we are with Facebook because of the fact that most people on Facebook have set their privacy settings in such a way that their posts aren't public. Mm-hmm. So people can kind of rest assured that we're not like seeing something that they don't realize that's out
there. You're not looking at my birthday pictures.
Right. It's nothing like that. We're not hacking to anybody's account or anything like that. We are only seeing what people have determined to be public.
This just opens up all kinds of possibilities for finding trends and seeing things. And really, I mean, there's a seriousness behind it because take something like the bird flu or the H1N1, whatever, mm-hmm. when we really did face a crisis of not having vaccine, just that couple extra weeks of lead time to develop and create more of a vaccine could save a lot of people a lot of misery.
Absolutely. And that's why we were so, we were just as surprised as everybody else was when we were able to call that early flu season this year and end up being 6 weeks before the CDC at least publicly announced it.
Yeah.
So being able to do this analysis in real time is what is allowing us to have that kind of early warning system.
Yeah. Well, Graham Dodge, thank you very much for coming in and good luck with sick weather and I'll certainly be checking it out.
Thank you very much.